You're listening to Potluck, the podcast that stirs up a unique flavor of people, culture, and brands in Asia. Hosted, as always, by Scott and Drago.
This is our third and final part of our discussion with Pete Smith. It's time for our quick fire round, Brand Burns. Pete, okay, moving on to flavor of the month. Now, what would you like to talk about? Do you want to pick a brand that's on your radar at the moment, you know, someone you're really impressed with recently? Or would you like to talk about some idea or a book that's kind of really, made you stop and think about stuff? Pick one, please.
Pick one. Sure. I think easy peasy. Okay. I think flavor of the month. Good question. I think I can talk about maybe there's a case study that I came across recently, which is old, but I thought was very interesting. And given that we're talking about Asia, insights, we're talking about interpretation, the value of feedback. I think sometimes there is a kind of an importance of cutting through things and trying to get to the essence. And there's a wonderful case study I read recently, which was about Honda getting into the U.S. Back in the 1950s, 1960s. And there was this amazing example of, and I think the English motorcycle industry in particular was really devastated when the Japanese ended up coming into the U.S. And England had, its triumph for some of the big motorbikes at that time were really quite prominent. They had a big market share there. And the Japanese kind of came out of nowhere and just decimated them. And in the space of about 2 years, the share of the market went from, I don't know, it was 30% or something, to like zero. And they were just like, what happened? And they ended up going into this, they hired a consulting company to kind of do an analysis of what did the Japanese do? How can we learn from this? What can we do? So the British government worked with this consulting company, and they ended up preparing this report, which was this amazing description about Japan Incorporated, right? The way that the METI kind of got together with Honda and they found economies of scale and they were able to exploit this and develop, the fact that Japan had different sort of sizes of motorbikes and 50cc bikes were very popular and they were able to get a technological benefit and they had government assistance and funding and all of this led into this thing. And it was this classic paper on how Japan dominates, right? And I think probably in the late 80s, you heard a lot more of this, where it was kind of, boy, we're all going to end up working for Japan someday because, boy, they work in such a different way and it's such a different model. So this case study was taught in business schools. It was, this is kind of the peril of what happens when you come across these actors that are coordinating with government bodies and making it all work. And what I thought was funny is that nobody actually asked anybody in Japan what happened, right? So the consultants worked in the UK and worked in New England, and they put all these brilliant reports together and they did all the analysis on the charts and the pricing and what they did. But no one actually talked to the guys at Honda and said, what was the strategy here?
Right.
So there was another academic researcher who was kind of curious about that and was like, he knew the case very well and he happened to be at a conference. And so he bumped into somebody from Honda and he was like, hey, do you think I might be able to talk to some of these guys, the leaders who moved from Japan and went to Los Angeles and kicked off this entire domination and talk to them about how they did it? And it was like, sure. So they arranged the meeting and he talked to the guys. And again, it was like that veterinarian, why did you choose to be a veterinarian? I didn't. I didn't. My father was a veterinarian, so that's why I became a vet. They asked the Honda executives, what was the strategy? And they were like, well, we didn't have a strategy. I was reading an English newspaper at my desk once, and my boss was walking by and went, oh, you speak English? Okay, great. We need you in Los Angeles. And so they relocated this small team of guys. And there was just, this series of errors, and they thought that the bikes were going to be big bikes, 300 cc's, it's America. But the Japanese company, not knowing how to build bikes, they developed clutch problems, mechanical problems very early. So because of that, they were like, oh no, our entire strategy is going to, so they had to stop selling the 300 cc bikes and they had to ship it back to fix the clutch and something like that in Japan. And meanwhile, they were stuck and they only had the 50cc bikes. Yeah. And meanwhile, there was an art student in Miami who was at the Miami Art School or something, who was developing his own portfolio. And he went to Gray for an interview. And, you know, he was being interviewed by Gray and he showed some of his spec work. And they were like, oh, this is an interesting idea. And it was for Honda. And yeah. And so Gray then bought the idea. I don't think they actually hired the guy, but they bought the idea and then went to.
What's
and
new?
Again, this might be all apocryphal. I'm not sure. But, you know, they went to Honda and said, hey, we had this interesting idea. And the five guys at Honda, two voted, you know, against it. They didn't think it was right. And three voted for it. But, you know, so they decided to give it a shot. And it was, you know, you meet the nicest people on a Honda. And it was this, you know, the little featuring the smaller bikes because they couldn't sell the bigger ones because they had the mechanical problems. So they thought, well, maybe we can do this campaign. You meet the nicest people on the Honda. So you've got housewives on these 50cc bikes. You've got kids on the back, you know, taking them to school. Mm. And suddenly this market opportunity exploded where suddenly it wasn't about big, powerful masculinity driving through, you know, it was just, you meet the nicest people on a Honda. And that just took off. And then, but again, in that spirit of intention, I think you have to do the research, you have to do the work, but you also have to talk to the people who did it. And I really believe that, you know, I found that to be such a funny story in a way to see, you know, how did Honda really succeed in the US? And at least in my experience in Japan, that rings true. That there's more kind of, yeah, that's how I ended up in this situation. And I'm a leaf in the wind. I'm kind of floating this way or that way. I'm reacting. I'm doing the best I can when I find myself in this situation. When I started working at the agency, I had a creative director who was working with me. And then one week I came in and he was now in charge of media. And I was like, how, what? But that's how Japanese organizations work. I worked with clients, you know, who were the marketing director of big brands in Japan. And 2 years ago, they were running a factory in Thailand. But, you know, Japanese move people within the companies. They have all kinds of experience, deep experience within the organization. But they don't have that kind of expertise model of like, you know, you need this guy who's like an expert at marketing or so on. Like it's they know everything about the company. So it's again, a different way of working. It's a different kind of intention. But it's a bit like, you know, as I said, I think sometimes Western companies, they need to have intention and meaning. Like, this is why we're going. We're going this way. There has to be a purpose. But actually, I think sometimes different things are happening all the time. And you have to try to get as good a picture of that as you can. But then just act and just do your best and see where you're going to land. So I think that to me was a case study that I thought was really interesting that kind of rolled up some of the things that were in my head at the time. Very interesting to see how that happened.
I think we often talk about, you know, beginner's mindset and stuff, yeah, in the Western context. But I think in the Japanese context, it's sort of, it's almost like, you know, a Japanese organization is kind of deliberately creating the opportunity for that, yeah? Maybe as a way to enable people to kind of, to be naive and to, you know, to question things, yeah? Much like people don't take holidays, so let's have 15 public holidays a year because otherwise everyone's going to, you know, pass out at their desk. You know, let's force them to take holiday. Let's force them to be naive and to question the assumptions that have been driving the business, yeah?
Yeah, I think that the danger is that if you end up in a position where people are just going along with the trend and they're not poking their heads up and looking around, and I think, you know, the execution is superb in Japan. The craft is superb. But sometimes, you know, the ability of individuals to poke their heads up and, you know, you can, I sometimes sort of felt, you know, it's like the Titanic or something and you're cruising along and everyone can see the iceberg and you're just like, can we, like, what else can we do here? And, you know, meanwhile, people are rearranging the deck chairs and, you know, getting things ready. So for the thing that's been scheduled. So I don't know, like, I think, you know, I think there's, I embrace the chaos. You know what I mean? Like I am not debilitated by that. I mean, I'm not also fatalistic. I like to think, like, I still think we have agency. I still think we have purpose. We have an ability to influence things, but I think there's a lot of chaos out there, but that's not a bad thing. And I, the thing I, you know, I was riding my bike earlier today, thinking about this interview and this coming thing. And one theme that I think I've been thinking about a bit recently is just this idea of like, you know, save me from smart, well-intentioned people. And there's a lot of people sometimes that, you know, feel they have to have a point of view, they have to make a comment, and they're kind of correct. And but at the same time, I don't know if we always need to be listening to everything. I mean, I think the there's you know, different examples I can think of this, but I think you know, podcasts. Trying podcasts. No, but you know, I presented creative work before, right? And you've got five people from the client on the other side of the table, and it's like the boss is at one end and the most junior guys at the other end. And it's, and you know, so they presented the work and it's like, so, you know, what do you think, you know, Jerry or Jenny or the person that, and then the young person is on the spot and they have to be like, and they very well authentically might think, I have no opinion on this at all. It seems okay. But they got to say something. And you know, so it becomes like, well, you know, I've read something that young people these days are really staying away from the color blue. Because so I think we need to be thinking about, you know, what that's a point we need to think about. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, next person, what do you think? Right. And you know, I think that at some point you got to just let it go. Like just roll and see where things go. And I think we have this instinct to overcomplicate things. You know, more professionalism, more structure. You know, I love the idea of the, you know, the startup in Silicon Valley, and there's five or six people and everyone's doing everything and there's no job titles and everybody's managing the product and shipping stuff and talking to press. But as soon as the company starts to grow, then it starts to structure and you need someone in this area and someone in this area and someone in this area. And it starts to specialize and you get more and more inertia built into organizations. And, you know, I read this other book by General Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis. I think in his book was called Call Sign Chaos. And, you know, he was in charge at one point of GEFCOM or something like that underneath Defense Secretary Robert Gates. And DEFCOM was something I think that was created after 9/11 to try to coordinate the different branches of the military. But, you know, it was thousands of people in Virginia kind of passing paper around. And what was kind of impressive was that they decided, you know what, we're not adding any value, so let's just close this. Like, we're, you know, the different departments were actually coordinating better. They had sort of, they'd improved, they solved the problem, but you don't need the structure anymore. So they actually abolished the entire the division, which is kind of a powerful thing to do if you're in charge of a division and you're like, well, actually, maybe we don't need this. And, you know, it makes me think of, you know, the Department of Administrative Affairs from Yes Minister, right? And it's the division, the department that's coordinating all the other actions of all the other departments. But there's so much truth in those wonderful Yes Minister, Yes Prime Minister kind of things about structure and bureaucracy. And, you know, sometimes you just have to break out of that and try to do things. And I, you know, I applaud the anytime you can try to get to a simpler place. And, you know, let's try to simplify this. Let's try to, living in Hong Kong, I was so impressed by the tax code there because it was sort of a 10-minute exercise to fill in my taxes. You know, whereas I, you know, it was a piece of paper folded over sort of four pages. How much do you make? What's 16% of that? You know, whatever. And then do you have any deductions? Simple, done. You know, and you could pay it on your credit card and you're finished. I think in the U.S. now, the tax code, depending on who you're talking to, but it's something like 75,000 pages, you know, because there's all these legal precedents and all these other things. But why is the tax code 75,000 pages? I don't know. But there's a lot of professionals that are very valuable and doing their best. And no one is actively evil. No one is trying to slow things down. Everyone is trying to add value, but you really have to try to channel it. Let's add value in the right place. So I think sometimes to me, like trying to be a little disruptive, trying to be a little bit outside the structure, trying to find shortcuts, trying to find better ways to do things. I always really enjoy that challenge.
Okay, let's move on to brand bullshit, Pete. So, you know, what in the world of marketing or brand building, if you like, do you feel is fallacy or maybe gets in the way of effective work? or effective strategy?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's a lot. I think, you know, again, I can talk to my own experience of writing case studies, and I think there's a kind of problem solution kind of mindset, which is like, this is what the problem was, this is what our solution was. And it kind of forces a structure onto things, which I'm not sure is actually there, having been in creative departments and worked with creative people when they're actually working on problems. So I don't know if it's really bullshit necessarily. Like, I think that's the interesting thing, is that you can be right. Like, it's absolutely right. From, you know, I had an example or experience where we had somebody from France coming in, and they were going to try to coordinate the media actions of the various maisons, and wanted to look for opportunities to, you know, invest in certain outdoor media properties, right? And the idea was that everyone would pay a certain portion into that, and then we would have that for 12 months, and we would share it amongst the different departments. And it kind of makes sense. Like, each different maison has a we can sort of benefit from the qualities of the group, and it makes sense. But at the same time, you know, when you get into the details of it, boy, it's really hard to get that right, because it's like, well, who gets it in December? Right. Mm. And like, I mean, that's the time when, for jewelry maisons, like, that's an important time of year. Like, you know, who wants it in February? Right. Yeah. Well, who's going to, you know, well, wait a minute. Yeah. I have an event that's happening in Ueno. I don't need a billboard in Shibuya. So there's like things that make sense when you look at them from one perspective, like economies of scale. Let's leverage this. Let's coordinate our activity. We can have a bigger impact, which are completely correct, like 100% right. But when you get into the details, it gets much more complicated. And I think you need to be able to look at both sides of that and kind of figure out, how do you take advantage of this, and how do you, you know, put it together without actually, you know, without ending up in a situation where you've just made it more complicated, but actually you haven't really driven much value. But that's something I think that's a challenge. So, you know, bullshit, I'm not sure. I think, you know, there's different levels, but I think everything is well-intentioned. You know, bullshit to me kind of implies a kind of malice, right? And you can talk about scam ads. You can talk about, you know, there is some, like, there's fraud. Like, I think there's some agencies out there that are like, you know, we did this amazing initiative, you know, floating a raft in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and it's helping refugees and whatever it is. Like, I mean, there's different stuff which is true, but it are being done for a, you know, award purposes or something like that. But I think that's somewhat suspect to me. But I think at the same time, I think most stuff is not ill-intentioned. Like, I don't think that there is kind of a desire to deceive. People are just doing their best. But I don't know if I would necessarily call it bullshit. But it would be, you know, people are being directed in the wrong direction, or they're not moving in the right way. Maybe you can find a better way to do it.
Okay, great, Pete. This brings us to the last question we have around fortunate failure. So an experience that you've had over the years that, you know, started out bad. In the end, it was a learning experience, something that led to growth. I was thinking, in order to give this conversation, let the snake bite its tail, as it were, you know, maybe you could, you know, talk about, you know, coming to Japan. Did you think it was kind of, back in the day, did you think it may be the wrong decision, but it didn't end up being that? Or maybe, you know, about your apprehension leaving Japan now, or it could be, you know, something else entirely.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm so happy to have had the opportunity to go to Japan. It's hard for me to separate my observations or feelings about Japan from sort of my career growth at the same time. Mm. Like, it's hard for me to know, because I'm now in my late 40s versus, you know, I was in my mid 30s when I came to Japan. Is my way of thinking changing because it's just kind of a career progression thing, or is it related to the locality? I'm not sure. I look at some of the stuff I've done when I'm younger, and I can be a bit embarrassed about it. And I think I necessarily wouldn't do it the same way. When I first joined the advertising agency in Toronto, I was coming out of finance. So I was maybe 5 or 6 years older than most of the other young account guys. So I was really eager to learn the business as fast as I could. So I volunteered for as much as I could do. And I ended up working on new business because that was kind of where a lot of exciting stuff was happening. And you work with the most senior people in the agency who are doing this, you know, compressed time frame, like doing really exciting stuff. And I was just carrying boards around and bags around. But I got to sit in the meeting rooms, right? So watching these really giants in my mind presenting business strategy, creative strategy, marketing strategy, asking tough, you know, answering tough questions from the clients. And I remember looking at these guys and I was just like, wow, like how are they able to answer these things so quickly? Like, boy, I'm never going to get to this level. And then I was working in Hong Kong and I was doing a new business pitch and I had an assistant with me. And I remember, you know, the pitch was going well and so on. And then, you know, the client asked me a question and I started responding and I looked over. I was like, well, what do you think? And then, you know, I saw her looking at me with these eyes and I was like, oh no. Like she thinks I know what I'm talking about. Like she thinks that I'm actually, oh, wait, oh no. I recognize that look because I used to give that look to my seniors and I saw it and I was like, oh, okay, no, you're wrong. But you know, I think
but
there is that growth. Yeah. And I think there's growth, right? And I think there has to be humility. And I have been so lucky. Mm. You know, I ended up in Japan. I'm half Japanese. So in one way, I can look back and connect the dots, right? Mm. I was born and I went to Japan when I was a kid and I had some experience there. And I got a study abroad program for the University of Toronto to study in Japan. And so, you know, that's why I'm here. But it's not like that. Like, you know, I met somebody at a conference at a BBDO meeting and they needed somebody and they're like, hey, would you be interested? And you know, it just kind of happened. And then I kind of made a life here. So it's there's a degree of randomness, but I really like it. And I think maybe originally I was more struggling against that randomness. Like I was more swimming against that current and trying to impose order and certainty. In a way that, you know, and I think sometimes agencies and research agencies and so on, what you're selling sometimes is, trust me, like this is what's going on, right?
I know exactly what I'm doing, yeah.
Well, Drago, I've never felt you know exactly what you're doing, but I think
that's because I've embraced randomness, mate.
Ah, perfect. You were just ahead of me on the curve. I hadn't been there yet. But you know, and I think, but I've come to kind of accept, okay, I'm never going to get 100%. And again, it may be very Japanese. It's journey, right? Like it's, how do I get better at this? How do I move a little bit closer to the end? How do I add a little more value? But I'm never going to have a complete answer. And probably I'm going to spend the rest of my life. And you could interview me in 15 years and who knows what I'm going to be doing then. But, you know, maybe I'm going to be having the same thing about like, well, I just discovered this and I'm trying to do this. And as long as I can keep chasing new things and trying to add value in whatever it is I'm doing, I'm pretty happy. So that I don't know if that's purely about failure, but maybe it's an acceptance of failure. And that's that makes me feel good.
The reframing of success. It's a brilliant story. Thank you very much.
Just one last bonus question, if you don't mind, Pete. So as we actually discussed before the podcast went live, so to speak, we talked about our food mini series, which is on the horizon imminently. And we're looking to sort of look at food as a vehicle for exploring, you know, culture and trends in the region. I'm just curious, we're just asking every guest this season if there's anything about food, particularly in an Asian context, they feel would be something worth exploring or digging into, you know, or just something which you'd be curious about hearing yourself.
I think it's a really rich territory, and I mean, I think the price of metaphor is eternal vigilance, right? Like you don't want to become so slavish to the metaphor that, you know, you're really stretching here and there. But I think
a slave to the metaphor, you say?
No. I would never say that on potluck. I'm enjoying stirring the pot with you right now, Drago. I really am.
Like a sous chef. Yeah, sorry.
The frisoir of this and that. Yeah. No, I think food is a great territory and there's so much there's so much I think you can pull out of culture with food. And I don't know if this was maybe before we started talking, but just talking about, you know, great cuisine and what it means for different cultures. And you can really learn a lot, I think, about a culture and the appreciation and the time they take to really express themselves through food. So I think it's creative. There's history, there's heritage, there's craft. There's a lot of exciting areas to go into, and maybe I might suggest maybe you could also add wine or alcohol into that as well, because there's some wonderful stories as well about alcohol and different cultures and the craft of that, and you know, Scotland versus Japan and whiskey and you know, be it sushi or be it other other cuisine. There's lots of great territory. So yeah, I'm looking forward to listening to some of these discoveries in the future.
Thanks a lot. Fantastic. Pete, thanks so much for coming on the pot, in the pot, and around the pot with us today. Hope you've had a good fill. We certainly have. It was amazing.
I'm exhausted and I'm full. So I think I need to lie down after this meal.
Well, it's almost Friday evening, so yeah, hopefully a chance for an aperitif soon. Thanks so much, Pete. And to our listeners, please don't forget to click subscribe to the pod. Keep those reviews coming. And in the meantime,
keep it brewing.